is correct, Matt? So we're doing two, just so we'll make sure we get it.
All right. This is October 21st, 1988. I'm Bob Marshall, and I'm with Frank Zappa. And
you better move the tape closer to the table. Talk loud. There's a bunch of people walking around
upstairs. All right. So we get another little screw out.
Do you okay like that?
Yeah.
There you go. So we have to be still.
Gerald, why don't you close that door now?
Okay, Frank, my first question. In your mini manifesto on Joe's Garage, where you talk about knowledge is not wisdom, and that little manifesto, at the end you say, music is the best. Capital M, capital U, capital S-I-C. What is music?
Well, in the terms, I would use two different definitions for it, you know, one in a clinical sense and one in the sense that it applies to that little statement on the album. And in the sense of the statement on the album, it would mean whatever you happen to think music is. I mean, that's a statement to other people, you know, and they would plug in to that statement their concept of what music is. So I'll recite it for you just for people who don't have the albums. Information is not knowledge. Knowledge is not wisdom. Wisdom is not truth. Truth is not beauty. Beauty is not love. Love is not music, and music is the best. So you get to figure out what your idea of music is and plug it into that.
Yeah, now, you see, I find that that little manifesto resonates so much with many points that you have said through the years in your interviews. For example, I don't know of it any earlier, but it was in the summer of 79, the Rolling Stones. I think that was one of the first times you talked about yourself as a journalist. Am I wrong? Did you talk about it in other interviews I'm not aware of earlier?
Well, I don't know whether or not I talked about it in interviews earlier, but there's always been a journalistic aspect to my work, even for my first album. Because if a person writes a song about a current event, that's a journalistic technique. And I would say, certainly, a song about the Watts Riot, which was on the Freak Out album, qualifies as some form of journalism, because it, you know, just... A lot of people don't even remember what the Watts Riot was.
Yeah.
And so at the point where you make the song, the Watts Riot was a recent journalistic event. You know, it was recently in the news. But over a period of years, people forget what the news was. Now it just becomes folklore. The fact is, Channel 5 in Los Angeles, which showed the pictures of the riot, did have a story about a woman sawed in half by 50 caliber machine gun bullets from the National Guard that was down there taking care of the riot.
Mm.
And that may be the only lasting monument to the woman who got sawed in half. You know? I mean, there's a lot of things like that in songs that go from journalism into folklore, that people and the events that they are involved in the songs were news at the time that they happened, but over a period of time, who cares about the news anymore? And then it's just folklore.
Well, I see that, and that's the opening word, information. I see you, and I relate that to your statement in the Life magazine this summer, that you hum the news. There seems to be a metaphor that you're replaying here, as music, your work is journalistic, yet you're turning the news as folklore into some kind of musical art form.
Well, that's an interesting way of juggling stuff around. I mean, there's a certain aspect of it, but I would say that the only part of the news that turns into the music is the lyrics.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty hard to convert something like election statistics into something that you can hum, really.
So you mean the news lyrics is what you hum, but don't you include the news of musical trends and where you do your satire of musical styles? Isn't there a trendy, newsy level there?
Well, usually by the time I'm making fun of it, it's no longer news. Because in order to make fun of something, everybody has to know the ground rules for the joke to work. So it's it would be ridiculous to make fun of punk orchestration, even if I had heard it the day that it was invented, unless everybody else had some idea of what punk sounded like so that you could make a parody of it. You know, you can't be newsworthy like in a timely fashion with musical parodies.
But it's when it's become an environment, cliche.
It's when it's saturated the cultural environment and everybody knows that people with hair sticking up in a certain direction with guitars totally out of tune banging a couple of chords for 1.5 minutes constitutes a musical form, but you can then make fun of it.
All right, well, so when you say you hum the news, you mean the lyrics?
Yeah, I'm talking more about the lyrics rather than the notes.
Is there an ethical question there about humming the news? Are you satirizing people's involvement in the news? I mean, people would see that you're entertaining the news, putting it in entertainment form. Some people might see it that way.
No, actually, what I do with the news is I have the ability to watch news from all different kinds of sources and remember the details and collate the details and come up with a conclusion other than which the people who own the media want you to come away with. If you watch only one news service, you're not getting the full picture. You know, they try and tell you major world events in 10 seconds, and you can't do that. And so what you have to do is compare different outlets, compare their spins, compare that to print, and then draw your conclusions and also reinforce that by firsthand conversations with people who might be there or might know something about it. I generally don't have access to those kinds of people when it's applied to U.S. politics, but in terms of things going on in other countries, the information you receive here about what happens outside the U.S. is really quite thin. And since I do travel around, it's easy for me to talk to people in the different countries and say, what really happened? And to that extent, I know more about foreign events than the average guy in the United States because I have some way to...
Correct access.
Yeah, to develop the picture a little bit.
Yeah.
And in fact, I got some extra information just last night on things that are happening in South America. And it puts me in a situation where the political part of my brain is looking at the world and saying, I see trends developing and they're really horrible. And the musician part of my brain says I would really like to be just sitting in that room and there working on the synth there because that's more fun than anything else. And I spend my day trying to put these two parts of my brain together, and usually what happens is at the end of the work period there'll be a product that comes out that is a combination of those two parts of my brain. What I know about what's going on in the world plus what I like to do with music.
Right, you're resolving, that's the process of resolving the dilemma of being a musical specialist in an information surround that makes you in touch with so many things, and then you add your particular slant to it through your own sources.
Yeah,
yeah, that's what I was interested in, you as a journalist, and I was wondering which was more prominent, the political or the musical, but you're saying you're not sure, you work out where you...
I know that at this point they seem to be about 50-50. You know, it's not exactly like being Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but it's hard for me to go in there and just work on music and forget about what's really going on in the world. I can't do it. I can't take what I know and throw it away and say, well, I just won't care anymore because I can't do anything about it. First of all, I think I might be able to do something about it. And just because I might, I have to keep thinking about it. So there's no easy way to dispose of it.
Yeah, so your activity... dealing with the PMRC, I guess, from 85 to 87, was not a radical departure from your interest. It was how you manifested that dilemma for yourself. That was the most direct, immediate concern that you could deal with. You had to go political at that point.
Well, I wouldn't say that was even going political. That was, you know, that was a civic obligation because I saw...
Well, that's what I mean by political. Do you mean something else? Do you mean propagandistic by political?
No. We have a little semantic problem here because usually the way I talk about politics, in one sense, I've said this many times in interviews, politics is the entertainment branch of industry.
Yeah.
And when I talk about my own political thoughts, I'm not talking about being part of the entertainment branch of industry. I'm talking more about policy in action. In other words, somebody has to decide to do certain things or not do certain things. And hopefully the person who makes that decision has made the decision based on accurate information, okay? problem with most of the decisions of the last 8 years in the Reagan administration is they're all ideologically based, and very seldom have the policy decisions been based on practicality or far long-range thinking. It's just been based on whether or not the rhetoric that appears in the news that day is in phase with conservative ideology or appeasement to certain interest groups. It's not good politics in the true sense of the word. And another political act that you have to bear in mind is as long as people have the right to vote, the vote should be cast in a situation where the person with the ballot in his hand has access to enough information to make a practical decision. And that's where I come in. If I can provide an extra dimension of information, which may, through this interview or through a record or some other way, get out to a person with a ballot in his hand, I'm doing a public service by providing compilations of data that the news won't give you. It's not they can't give you, they won't give it to you. So that's the way I think about politics, the way I'm involved in it.
All right. Okay. Taking the statement that I guess you made it back in your statement to Hey Warner Brothers executive, that
Face Nazi is right.
Yeah, and about conceptual continuity. In there is the statement that we make a special art in an environment hostile to dreamers.
That's right. The environment that is hostile to dreamers is always the environment that is run by right-wing administrations. Because in order for the right-wing administration to maintain its fiction, it has to be ideologically pure, and that ideology does not admit for creativity. There's nothing creative about a right-wing administration. The whole goal of it is to freeze time and to move things backwards. So, obviously, the people who are most at risk whenever there's a right-wing administration sitting in place is anybody who's an intellectual, a dreamer, or a creative person in any field. They are at risk because they pose a threat to the administration.
Okay, but you were quite vocal about certain left-wing elements in the 60s.
I don't think that the left-wing is anything to invest in. I think that the left-wing has probably done as much damage as any other kind of political force. You know, I think common sense is the way to go. And common sense, there's no ideology for common sense. It's easy to talk about politics in terms of right and left-wing because that's the way the news portrays it. And so to a degree, if I talk about political things, I have to use the common parlance that people understand it. But, you know, I think of myself as a person devoted to practical and common sense solutions to things that are real problems. And they oftentimes sound weird, if suggested, simply because people are so attached to the ideological ramblings of the right or the ideological ramblings of the left. You know, they think that you have to choose between these two extremes. You know, on the left, you've got communism. Well, communism doesn't work. It absolutely doesn't work. And on the right, you have fascism, and that doesn't work either.
So both environments are hostile to dreamers, both political and
ideology. No, because the difference here is that the left has often employed artists and creative people in order to further their goals. And those, in one situation, for the right-wing administration, the artists and dreamers are a threat to their way of life. And for the left-wing guys, the artists and dreamers are commodities or objects to be used to further their propaganda. See, so there's a danger coming from both directions. One side would like to snuff you out, and the other side would like to co-opt you and usurp you in order to have you do stuff to promote their ideals. So anybody who's got an imagination has to watch out for both sides. There's only one place where you're safe, and that's in the middle.
Yeah, so you think you could work with a creatively sympathetic group like the leftists and keep them on their toes? You wouldn't be co-opted. That'd be better than a right.
I'm not interested in working with any leftist organization. I tell you the truth. I've said it many times.
Well, I mean, work in their environment.
No, fuck their environment, because I refuse to be used by any of those people.
But you know, but you emphasized at the beginning that the right wing was threatening for you.
The right would like to put you out of business, and the left would like to hire you. And I'm not for hire. And I don't think that anybody who has a truly individualistic way of evaluating the world or a creative urge to do unique stuff needs to be snuffed out or hired. You should be free to do what your abilities will allow you to do. Because it is only when you're free to do that that the benefits of what you can build will be distributed to those parts of the society who will find your work useful. You can't. Really creative people don't work good as employees.
Mm. But you're saying there's a more of a threat in the right-wing environment.
Yeah, that's the threat of death.
Okay, all right. you think of yourself as having common sense. Would you relate the word art as a sensory training or common sense sensory perceptions, or is that too dramatic?
Well, I think that it's, the word art has been pretty much flogged into porridge. You know, today you hear the word art and you think of people who do paintings and have their work admired by rich people at cocktail parties. And, you know, it conjures up a world of phony stuff. And I don't participate in that world. I'm happy that it's there for the people who like it. You know, it's a nice form of entertainment for them. But to me, that's not what it's all about. I don't think that training people to consume art in that sense makes them any more sensitive, more highly developed or refined in any way. It doesn't make them a better person. It just makes them a dupe for a bogus way of life. What that art world really is a way of abusing the people who made the art in the first place. Like, the best example is the common Soho gallery split, 60-40, 60% for the gallery owner, 40% for the artist. I mean, in the worst rock and roll record contract, you don't get that kind of a reaming. so much for the art world.
Okay, then, you have said that you can, I think, way back in New York Times about 1970, you said, my work is art. I think you mean art in a different way there.
Yeah. If I think of it as being a pure expression of who I am, what I do, and what I think, that's fine. And I'll call it art, but I'll call that fine. You know, I'm not, you gotta understand, I'm not walking around with an art banner in my hand. I mean, the problem with communicating with anybody in the English language is so much damage has been done to the language itself by advertisers, by political campaigns, and the words themselves have been mutated to the point where we have to choose them really carefully. Because even if, in fact, it is art, you don't want to say it's art because the negative connotations of calling it art puts a weird spin on what you're saying. So I generally try and avoid any connection with that word, you know, just because it impedes the process of trying to get your point across. You know, if you're going to talk to somebody, you want to talk to them in a language they can understand using words that they're familiar with. That should be a goal for communication.
Yes.
And art's one of the bad words these days.
All right. Now, in other words, you target an audience for the point you want to get across.
Yeah.
That's the traditional art of rhetoric in classical education. I don't know if you came across that.
Well, rhetorical technique. I didn't have classical education, so I don't know if it was that.
Right. All right. So one would say that your emphasis is rhetorical, not in the modern propagandistic sense, but targeting an audience, not necessarily for the whole album, but particular songs.
Well, targeting is the wrong word because, see, that presumes that it's now cast and it's not.
Yeah.
You know, what I have to do is make an assumption about the comprehension abilities of the people that would be the likely consumers for what I do. In other words, I have to conjure up in my brain an imaginary picture of who the guy is, how smart he is, how many references he might have that I can make, metaphorical references in the work. I have to have some sort of a plan, okay? And then once I've made that model, I can then decide, as I'm writing the piece, is this going to whiz over his head? Is this going to whiz past him? Or what's going to happen? Yeah, what is it? And if so, should it go in there anyway, or should I change it and say it blunt? And
that's part of your composing process.
Yeah.
This thinking.
And in order to arrive at that imaginary model of the person who's listening to the stuff, it's not based on thin air. I mean, I actually talk to the people who are fans for what I do. I've met them, I've talked to them. I have some idea of what their desires are, I know what they like, what they don't like, and to the extent that I have personal contact with them, that's the data that went into building the model.
So you do say all your music is an extension of you, but you then say the audience is the employer in other quotes.
That's true. The music is an extension of me, but the me is an entity that knows certain things.
Yeah.
Part of what I know is what the audience is interested in. And so that doesn't seem incongruous at all.
Yeah.
The audience employs me to entertain them. By purchasing an album, you have hired me to entertain you for 40 minutes or whatever it is in the album. And my goal is to do that in a way that is going to be useful to you.
I remember there was a quote, I think back, it was 1970, where someone is, maybe it was part of that Warner Brothers, that someone is getting off of this beyond his or her wildest comprehension.
I've had letters from people saying, it was me, it was me.
Well, I think I claimed that to you in 1985 myself.
Look at my head, the top of my head is gone. It was me, I can prove it.
I'm dead. Well, what did you think you meant and target that, or was that just a general principle?
I know that you have to have an average, okay, of what is going out there. And when you opt to do the thing that is going to whiz over most people's heads, you know that there's going to be a certain percentage in there that will be tall enough where it's going to get them right in the middle of their head. So
that's targeted.
That's the targeted audience. See, I don't know too many of those kinds of people who really get it all. That would be a truly rare individual. Because in order for them to get it all, they'd have to know what I know, which means not that I'm so smart, but I've had experiences that they haven't had, just because people are unique. You know? So
yeah.
Nobody gets 100%, but if anybody ever got 60%, they'd be in big trouble.
Now, big trouble from, I mean, is that a facetious remark?
Yeah.
Okay. I think it was on Hot Rats, you said, this movie for your ears. Remember that phrase?
Mm-hmm.
Well, a rather intelligent critic at that time, not known by many people, described your work up to that point as a visualization of a kaleidoscope of textures. And you take that phrase, visualization, with that statement said that you said, it incorporates your work, any available visual medium, consciousness of all participants, including audience, which we've talked about, all perceptual deficiencies, and a few other points. Why do you say any available visual medium? Because most people would think of you as a musician.
That's only because they don't know what I can do in the other medium. I've always been able to manipulate pictures. Since I first got a hold of a pencil and paper, I mean, I started off drawing before I could.
Before you had music in your head?
Yeah. There was no music in our household when I was a kid. Came to it late. But I've always been interested in the way in which pictures work with music. And the problem about doing more of it is that a visual medium is a far more expensive medium than the audio medium. An independent guy can afford to make an album easier than he can afford to make a movie, or he can afford to make a video and have some quality. So it is only occasionally that I can scrape up enough money to do a project that involves pictures and music. So that part of my work is less known than the records that I have out. And that's one of the reasons for putting Honker Home Video together, because at least in that, with that company, some of the things that I've done working with visual stuff can be gotten out to the public.
But the use of the phrase movie for your ears, you say here, you emphasize the visual. Are you, do you wish you could make a movie? Is the conceptual continuity a movie?
No, because in order to make it complete, you have to involve what you see. I mean, it's a total sensory thing.
Yeah, in other words, is that your definition of music, including all senses?
No, well, if you get to the other definition of music that I use when I'm working on my stuff,
yeah,
it means, it is the organization of any data.
Visual?
Anything. Yes.
No.
Choreography? Anything. Any data. It's long as you say to yourself, I'm now making a musical composition out of this stuff, the composition can include stuff that's living in this ashtray, whatever it is, as long as you willfully organize it into that object that you're making.
Well,
and that's the criteria that I would use.
Now, that would be a criterion that's modern, a product of television, because television uses all data. Is there? I always thought it was interesting that you had yourself in a TV screen, a freakout. You know, the cover image that always struck me as a color TV image. The coloring?
Yeah. Well, that's not supposed to be a plant, but...
It had the lines. It looked like a damaged color TV. The coloring. But you did not intend that.
No.
Okay, I projected that in there. But I find it interesting. I don't think earlier composers would talk about using all data the way you're doing, unless there have been. Correct.
As far as I know, I don't think there's anybody that has worked in the worked in contemporary composition that has the familiarity with the technical side that I do. I'm not talking about electronic music composers. I'm talking about just the general knowledge of all different
media.
Yeah, just every tool that you can use. If I can't get in with a soldering iron and fix it or build it, I certainly know how to use it and what some uses might be of the tool that the guy who invented it never imagined. You know, that's one of my specialties, is taking existing off-the-shelf stuff and twisting it to do something that the guy who manufactured it never thought it would be useful. That's a hobby.
And that's weren't you asked to make the band Mother's Invention, you were asked to add on of Invention?
Yeah. Well, we were just told we couldn't use the name Mother's.
So you suggested Mother's Invention?
Yeah.
But that was an accurate statement of your talents, to work with many technologies.
That wasn't the reason for sticking on it. It was just a practical decision that had to be made at the time that we got album, because they were refusing to release the album, because they claimed it was so stupid. You can imagine A&R department at Verve Records saying, we can't release this record because no disc jockey will play a song by the Mothers on the radio. Well, no disc jockey would play the content of the record, no matter what the name of the group was.
Yeah.
You could have called it the Smelts or something. They still wouldn't have played it. But that's the way it was. People were just afraid. And I guess they're still afraid.
But you don't have a... I'm going to move into... your role as a symbolist, you know, the symbolist group in art history.
I'm not familiar with art history.
All right.
Tell me about it.
Well, the symbolists broke up normal images and reformed them, juxtaposed them. A symbol, I think, came from...
Is this based on Jung?
No, this was before Jung. This is 100 years ago. The poets like Rimbaud, Baudelaire, literary historians grouped them into this movement called the Symbolists. There was a man who wrote a book at just before the turn of the century called the Symbolist Movement, so he kind of tagged that name on it. But it was the emphasis on a symbol as the primary focus and motive for your art piece.
Well, I suppose I belong in there. I mean, anybody who's said as much as I have about poodles ought to have some sort of a recommendation of that group, but it wasn't because I decided to join the movement.
Yeah, maybe there are historical forces, ways of thinking that you tapped into and are continuing a tradition consciously, unconsciously rather. I mean, from a critic's point of view, you're using these motifs and playing over. I think it was Miles who was the first one who wrote about your turnover of motifs, repetition of motifs in early articles, late 60s, early 70s. And I remember one of his questions for Edit magazine, International Times, he said, is there an idea, it was capitalized in the interview, is there an idea behind your work? And I think that's what I'm trying to get at. And I think
that's simple. It's the emperor's not wearing any clothes. Never has, never will.
What is the emperor?
Fill in the blank.
So the idea is it's you're making a symbol that allows other people to participate in it.
That's audience participation on a grand scale.
But
it's like name your poison.
Yeah. All right. One idea I always want.
Well, that's almost elegant.
What is?
The structuring something in a way that people get to participate in it, you know, by adding their missing ingredients.
Well, that
like
is
be your own catalyst.
But that is a tradition that T.S. Eliot and the poets and Joyce and Pound, they articulated that when people asked him the meaning of the poem, he would shrug his shoulders and then they would give what they thought it meant. And Eliot was
right.
They said, you're right.
Well, see, I didn't have that kind of an education. I have no knowledge of the history of art or poetry or any of that kind of stuff. It never interested me. You know, I think that it's nice that it's there for people who want it, but I never studied it. I don't know anything about that. I just did my own stuff. If it happens to be similar to other things that other people have done, fine, I can't help that. You know, but it's not like I went to college, learned about all these people who did bitchin' stuff through the years and decided to go out and do that. That is not interesting to me. All I can say is, yeah, they're doing it right.
Yeah, you would agree with that method. You don't know why you wanted to create in that method. Is it because you would say, I'm a nice guy, I'll include you? Is there a democratic impulse there?
No, I think that democracy, the jury's still out on democracy as a
viable institution.
That's right. You know, I keep referring back to the book that I had when I was in high school in our civics class. It was called Democracy, the American Experiment. And I think we're still experimenting, and right now it looks like some of the ingredients they put in don't really work.
The dog thing, I think people might say, why the dog image?
I don't even know how that got started. I mean, it's just like the whole idea of a poodle. There's certain absurd things about a poodle as a species unto itself. What especially women have decided to do to poodles is probably something that if there were a big guy on the clouds who needed out punishment at the time of the demise, that there would be a lot of women that would be tortured forever in the lake of fire for things that they've decided to inflict on poodles. You know, so that's a pretty good metaphor there, you know, for if you really think about it.
Well, perverse creativity?
No, well, look, a poodle is born. It's got hair evenly distributed all over its small, piquant, canine-type body. Figure it out. They don't start looking weird until some woman decides that they want to shape all that stuff to make it look like a walking shrubbery. You know, now, that's kind of, it tells you two things, that the dog's cooperative and that the woman's got some problems.
The mother invented us. A problem there. They're inventing.
Yeah, but did they invent something good?
Yeah.
Do you think a partially denuded small animal is good?
Well, it seems some people like it, so we have to allow them to have that choice, right?
Or yeah, but doesn't the poodle have some rights here?
Okay.
I mean, we're trying to save the whales. They're stuck up there. There's three whales with their noses sticking out of a hole. And everybody's spending... Now the Russians want to send an icebreaker. It's 300 miles away. The Russians are going to save the whales. Okay, what about the poodles? Who's doing anything for the poodles?
Right, save
you know?
The poodles.
I mean, you could start...
Who's plucking the poodles?
What?
Who's plucking?
That's right.
Who's fluking and plucking? Well, then that, to me, that's a symbol of you and your journalistic work of putting out information for Americans who are not getting, or getting pluked and need to be...
Unpluked?
Yeah.
Well, I think they do need to be unpluked, but the problem with Americans is they have this self-image of we're so nice, we're so fair, we're so honest, we always take the high road. If only it were true, this would be heaven on earth. But it's not true. And when you see 240 million people willingly deluding themselves with this idea that they're somehow God's chosen people, I find that to be a huge... I mean,
that's
continental bad mental health is what it is.
Continental?
Continental bad mental health.
Well, that's the cheese that you talked about in your Newsweek editorial that you print, right?
Yeah.
Well...
I mean, how can we be so foolish as to think that we've got it all? We certainly don't. And anybody who ever traveled for 20 minutes and kept his eyes open must realize that the United States, no country has got everything. You just don't have it. I mean, the major deficiencies in the United States seem to be that it's got a history that only goes back a couple of hundred years, and that history itself is riddled with corruption. It is riddled with exploitation of you name it, we have exploited it. You know, and it's not exactly something to be proud of. If whatever we have achieved, we had come by it honest, we'd be in a lot better shape. But really, we haven't. We've abused a lot of people, not only here in our own country, but around the world, and then gone to church to smooth it over. And had some guy say, yes, we're God's chosen people, and this is our manifest destiny, to be the peacekeepers for the world. I wonder, with this aesthetic that they have in the United States, whether... We don't have the right to inflict it on anybody else. I believe that. We certainly don't have the right to inflict it. But even if we had the right, would that other person benefit from becoming more like us? Countries that have cultures that go back thousands and thousands of years, and we walk in, and we want to give them Coca-Cola. Why?
Well, you're speaking as an American citizen. There would be probably many people in other countries who feel that their citizens, fellow citizens, are a bit deluded, you know, patriotic, too patriotic about their cultural values. So you're speaking as an American citizen.
Well, I think that the American situation is probably more critical than, saying, the guy from Borneo who believes that, you know, we are where it's at. You know, at least the guy from Borneo isn't going around doing some tricks in Central America and, you know, wherever else we've got little covert operations going on. He's not trying to inflict his values on another society. Whereas, especially through the missionary procedure, coming out from the United States, we have spread the poison of our ignorance to other cultures, to the detriment of those cultures, almost since this place was founded. America was founded by the refuse of the religious fanatics of England. These undesirable elements that came over on the Mayflower, ignorant religious fanatics, who land here, abuse the Indians, and then go to bed with a board down the middle, you know, the bundling board, so they don't have sex. That's how we got started, okay? And when we think back to our founding fathers, they don't never talk about the founding mothers, and that might be a little bit too risque. You know, they didn't want to have too much to do with them anyway, because what kind of a woman wants to take a ride on a wooden boat in the middle of winter anyway? Because not probably something you want to see in Playboy magazine. The way we got started and what we have turned into and our desire to inflict it on other people all over the world, I think, is a tragedy. And something big is going to happen in 1992 when Europe, if they can get their act together, if they can organize themselves the way that they are trying to do it, to the kind of the United States of Europe, that, as a consumer block and as a manufacturing block, is going to be larger than the United States. That's 330 million people or something like that, that make products that work. Hi, Gail.
Hi. How are you doing?
Right in the middle of an interview.
Yeah, I want to tell you.
Okay, who?
Sorry.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Yes, and that is the impetus for free trade, I think. Canadian businesses know they've got to get together with the United States to compete with this block that's coming up.
Well, here's the thing. What they make in Europe, those products seem to be more desirable than the products that are made elsewhere, except in Japan, as we all know, makes stuff that everybody wants.
You mean now? In the world market, Europe's products are very desirable?
Yeah. And if the United States continues the way it's going, like thriving on rhetoric rather than on practical solutions, in 4 years, when they've got their United States of Europe, we will have slid even further, and the United States is going to be in a very vulnerable position, even if it makes an alliance with Canada in order to make a large bloc, because the size of the bloc doesn't increase the quality of your product. It just means more people sharing a common, an absence of trade barriers to buy more stuff from someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, the United States is 240 million people dumb enough to buy anything that anybody sells them, and smart enough not to buy their own stuff. Okay?
Yeah.
And that is not something that you can continue for a century. You can't go for 100 years just buying everybody else's stuff. Sooner or later, you're going to have to, we're being very general here, you're going to have to redevelop the product base in the United States so that we buy our own stuff and that our commodities become valuable to people elsewhere. This trade imbalance is not a joke. It has long-range implications that could be very severe. And for every American that dreams of the American way of life and owning your own little home with a white picket fence and living next door to somebody who looks like Jimmy Stewart, they ain't going to get it.
All right, now, I remember you saying a few years in an interview talking about the inability of Europe to come together, you know, the tribal hostilities that go back centuries.
That's right.
And you preferred the basic unity in America. That was a value you admired in America,
mm-hmm.
or in the structure here. You are talking, again, as a citizen about the threat of what's going to happen in Europe. It may help you. It might be good for you if you buy the products. It helps your musical apparatus, but...
No, I didn't say either of those two things. I'm talking generally about the difference between Europe the way it is now, hacking it out with intertribal debates
yeah.
that have been going on for a couple of thousand years, and having the opportunity to blend some of that stuff together in 1992 to give that whole region the kind of cohesion that the United States would have under ideal conditions. I'm making a comment about that. And meanwhile, I would say the reverse is happening in the United States. We are breaking up into regions. It's the North versus the South and the East versus the West. The West, very much, in politics and every other thing. We're moving apart.
Yeah, I saw a book that came up years ago, The Nine Nations of North America. It breaks it down like that, the different regions. So, and Marshall McLuhan predicted this fragmentation that would come to the States and doom the United States to be a bunch of little bickering mini-states. You see that coming.
I see it.
And
let me tell you about another trend that I see, as long as we're talking trends here. the amount of money that is generated by cocaine that flows directly into the hands of the cartels that make the cocaine is right now translating into political power, and over the next, say, 25 to 50 years, will translate into even more political power for those people. They will transcend governments. Because there's something that I heard about last night that I imagined that this could happen. And it turns out I was right. This friend of mine who spent some time in Brazil verified the fact that the cocaine cartels have gone into the worst slums in Brazil and played Robin Hood to the people there. They're giving them cocaine profits to give them clothes and set up these little fiefdoms. Well, basically what they've created is an army of people who are willing to protect them. The police can't even go into those slums because they're at risk. Those slums are literally under the control of the guy from Colombia with a bag of money in his hand. Okay? Now, as a test balloon, I would say what's happened in Rio with that would indicate to any good businessman, and I would presume that these cocaine guys are good businessmen, that's the way to go. Think of every place in the world where you have an underclass. It's poor and it's being pushed down by the middle class directly above, in the case of the United States, or the upper crust that, you know, does all their bad stuff. Well, who is going to take care of these people? In the United States, you've got a homeless underclass that's developing that is unprecedented. If the cocaine cartel came into the United States and helped the homeless, what do you think would happen to the war on drugs here? I mean, playing Robin Hood is easy when you've got that kind of a profit base. It is so peculiar to think about that. And I predict that there is going to be more of that happening all over the world, that the people who have the dollars to invest, I mean, it doesn't cost that much to give people a little something to eat, and a little something to wear. When they got nothing, anything looks good. You don't have to be a major benefactor. Just give them a little present and you're a good guy.
Now, two people who predicted that too were Mae Russell. I'll make this comment. Were two people were Mae Russell and a person who's running for president of the United States and been doing for several years is Lyndon LaRouche. He has mapped that out. His information, his magazine is very good for charting these cocaine cartels. And would you support a president who would want to fight that trend? A presidential candidate who was honest about that.
I certainly wouldn't support Lyndon LaRouche.
Oh, we didn't put that on this one.
I'm going.
You got, where'd you get the new tape?
Out of the air. You just talk a little louder, Bob, so I know.
Especially in the United States. This country has a history of an anti-intellectual history that goes back to the first Fundamental Court. You know, thinking is bad for you. As a matter of fact, you can trace it back to the beginning of Christian doctrine. The whole foundation of Christianity is based on the idea that intellectualism is the work of the devil. You remember the apple on the tree?
Yeah.
It was the tree of knowledge. You know, you eat this apple, you're going to be smart as God. We can't have that.
Hello.
Let's get one thing straight. Besides the universe being just a matter of weights, knowing that that's a big number, but you know, behavior of molecules is a matter of weights. And molecules translated into the real world where we can kind of deal with it on a regular basis, move into the realm of chemistry. And so it is with intelligence. I think it has a lot to do with mechanical processes that take place in the brain. I think you can make people artificially stupid. Quavers is an example. It's a chemical way of producing stupid behavior. And conversely, there must be a way chemically to make people perform better. I don't know what it is, but if there are chemical substances which people will willingly ingest to produce stupid behavior, one day somebody will come up with something that will make it possible for you to think better. I'm not talking about LSD, but you know, some other way will just allow you to improve your processing capabilities. Just like we were talking about the difference between the original Apple computer, where you have to wait 10 minutes for your thing to go clonk clonk and see three words on the screen, to stuff that is available in the marketplace now that is about faster. It's doing the same job, just doing it in a more efficient way.
Yeah, that's what we were talking before. You were explaining the tree of knowledge. That was the point.
Oh, yeah, it's about Christianity. When Adam and Eve went to the Garden of Eden, to go follow this fairy tale, that evil woman convinced the man to eat the apple, but the apple came from the tree of knowledge. And the punishment that was then handed down, the woman gets to bleed and the guy's got to go to work, is the result of a man desiring, because his woman suggested that it would be a good idea, that he get all the knowledge that was supposedly the property and domain of God. So that right away sets up Christianity as an anti-intellectual religion. You never want to be that smart. If you're a woman, it's going to be running down your leg, and if you're a guy, you're going to be in the salt mines for the rest of your life. So just be a dumb fuck, and you'll all go to heaven. That's the subtext of Christianity.
The earlier part, we were talking about people with dream knowledge, I suppose, having some chemical means of making people smarter. I think if we...
maybe it's an apple.
The text of Uncle Newt on the album, back in '69, was about taking losing the jets and the days of growth. mechanism and using a lot of metaphors using sound that made vegetables grow better, things like that, animals. Were you getting at this, what you were talking about, your vision of seeing that we could be optimistic because someday they're going to make people better, maybe with sound?
Well, why not with sound? Because largest organ in the human body, correct me if I'm wrong, is your skin. And your eardrum is only part of your skin, folks. You know, so that may be the most sensitive part of the skin, but I believe the whole skin responds to sound. And different parts of the skin over different parts of the body have different resonant frequencies. In other words, frequencies that strike them better. Because of the size of the eardrum, it has a center frequency susceptibility at around 2K. That's why telephones sound like telephones. Your ear is most sensitive around 2 kilohertz. They can hear other things, but that's the real sensitive range. So maybe other larger patches of skin resonate with other different frequencies. There's been research done that show that certain frequencies at certain amplitudes produce physical effects. 10 cycles of a certain amplitude stops your heart. You can die from sound. You wouldn't even hear 10 cycles in the traditional sense of the word, because your ear doesn't go down that low, but a couple of your groups are dead. And there are frequencies that will make you piss, and frequencies that will make you shit, and frequencies that will make you do all kinds of things. I don't think they've discerned the entire range of them, but there is a connection between human organisms and the way moving air molecules affect that organism. So we shouldn't be so short-sighted as to rule out the possibility that therapies for different kinds of conditions, as well as the ability to kill people, could all be produced by sound. And the clue to that might be, you know, the soothing effect that certain types of music have on certain individuals. And the trick is, what passes for nice music in one culture is radically different than nice music in another culture. I doubt seriously that most Americans would find it soothing to listen to 6 hours of Chinese music. But I don't think that the Chinese would find it too soothing to listen to 6 hours of Barry Manilow either. So each culture has a different ideal of what constitutes good music. But the thing that is existing in the music that transcends the style, the orchestration, the timbre of music is the pitches of the notes. So that may be the determining factor.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's an idea that Mark Foreman tossed around that music was each slowed down. And he said the reason cultures have different musical tastes is it isn't really connected to language. So obviously the rhythms of Chinese music are connected to the way they speak, and that's Chinese
large part of Chinese. It's not the rhythm. The thing that sets the Chinese music apart, the rhythms of Chinese music are similar to the rhythms of other music. It's the timbre of it. It's the texture.
What do you mean, pitch?
No, the pitch. Timbre is the texture, the sound quality. In other words, is it being played by a snare drum? Is it being played by an oboe? Is it being played by a tuba? That's the timbre. The pitch is the frequency, the vibrational frequency of the note being played, no matter what instrument is playing. That's pitch. Rhythm is the way, the period, the distance between one note and another. That constitutes the rhythm. And the harmony is there's an either implied or explicit harmonic domain in which all the action takes place. It's like the canvas on which everything happens. The same melody note, the same melody line, with a major chord supporting it, is a different story when a minor chord is supporting it. The message that comes through is different. So that's how the things interact. The harmony tells you how to perceive the melody. Mm-hmm. It tells you, that's the compass.
Yeah.
That shows you which way north is. The rhythm determines how fast the piece is going, so you can determine whether or not the piece is above your factory rate.
Yeah.
Or the rhythm determines the distance, the periodicity between one start time and another of each of the pitches in the melody line. So that's how it's correct. And the timbre is going to send you a message about the certain other qualities of the line. For example, the dumbest example of all time is Purple Haze played an accordion. It's a different story than Purple Haze on a plus one guitar. They play exactly the same notes, but there's two different messages. So that's one of the main differences culturally, place to place in the music, is in the timbre of the instruments which you're playing the music. Chinese music, to use an extreme example, has certain types of flutes, certain types of little stringed instruments and little bowed instruments that have a certain nasal quality to them,
yeah,
which would not be an admired texture in a Western society. But to the Chinese, that is their music, and it's perfect and it's wonderful. They think that it's the way things ought to be, and whereas we in America think the Bruce Springsteen is the next best thing to Michael Jackson.
All right, so when I said rhythm, I would include all factors, but you were saying earlier about, you say that pitch makes a key for this making people intelligent from sound.
I'm not saying making people intelligent. I'm saying if we allow ourselves to consider the possibility of audio being used as a tool for therapy, really what you're doing is using certain frequencies aimed at certain parts of the body in order to set up a resonance. In other words, you can knock down a bridge,
yeah,
with the right resonance, because you'll find the resonant frequency of the concrete that's holding it up, and it's going to crack. And the same thing could be true of a crystalline situation in the human body. You want to crack it, you've got to find the resonant frequency of that crystal, and it's gone. Like the right note could be a cure for gout, where you have uric acid crystals located in a joint someplace. How are you going to get in there? The guy can't move his joint anymore because the crystals is kept his joint. So, yep, find the right frequency, aim it at it, turn up the volume, and you're gone.
Well, I'm sure some people have explored this one.
Yeah, that's radio.
Yeah?
Yeah, they have. Well, there's different things. Like, medically, there's the gallstone.
Oh, yeah, that's
shattering devices with ultrasound. But there's radionics machines that measure the frequency of all the organs. Mm-hmm. If the frequency is not normal, you can plug in the normal frequency and fix it.
Well, sure. Now, you used to have, I guess, on your recording miles on your door, Dr. Zircon back in the 70s. Is that on your door in this house?
Possible.
Yeah. Because you kind of incorporate several roles. Right? You're talking health, or you're talking healing, the alchemy, that was brought up in the alchemy, you touched on it, it doesn't show up too much later in other parts. But you see yourself. And this relates to something you said to you. Rolling Stone interview. I think they asked you anything more to say, or maybe you just asked. Can I say one more thing? You brought up this your trial. I said one is being tried. You should be tried by your peer group. Whether you address the legal world and you're addressing the medical world here, do you see the way you're using the music in many roles, other than just the specialist?
I think you're blowing it out of proportion. The fact is, I'm a guy who has an operating brain. I'm in the process constantly of bringing in data and sorting it and drawing conclusions. You do an interview with me, I deliver to you today's conclusions. You know, if you happen to ask the right question about something that I've thought about, I'll give you what my up-to-the-minute take is on any given conclusion on any given topic at that point. It's fun. You know, it's not like I have a mission to go out and help the medical profession or the legal profession. I think about different things. And the reason why I would be triggered to think about the thing would be, I might see a news story or somebody might say something, and it doesn't just go by me. I think about it. I think about my environment, so I don't have any choice. That's just the way I am. I can't turn it off. So if I come up with a conclusion and somebody asks me a question about certain topics, then I'm going to give you my conclusion rather than textbook knowledge. I didn't learn my shit from reading a book. You know, I figured it out, and I've been right a lot of times. And, you know, if I would have gone to college, I couldn't have done any better.
Yeah, so where I'm maybe a bit limited here is trying to project a certain strategy and
the
ethical
about that
element.
Well, let me talk about that peer group. You talk about what the Constitution provides, trial by a jury of your peers. I would say that would be one of the most precious commodities that a person could obtain in the United States today. because how the people who are available to sit on a jury anymore are not peers of anyone. How do you get a fair trial? And especially if you're dealing with complicated financial matters, complicated technical matters, and your peers are not your peers. Who's Ivan Boesky's peers? You know, what do they
David
do?
Rockefeller.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, in theory, for him to get a fair trial, he would have had to have a jury of his peers. Where are they? And then, and even more grotesque, where are Charles Manson's peers?
Well, then, it doesn't make sense, the idea of him tried by your peers.
Well, on the one hand, if you want to stick to what the Constitution says, you know, and treat it with some respect, and at least go along with the idea of democracy, then you ought to live by the letter of the law. If you find out the law is no good, then you ought to change the goddamn thing, or live a lie.
Well, some of the problems in Canada is that the medical profession is criticized for keeping the trial judgment of their peers in-house. Isn't that right, John?
That happens everywhere, though. I mean, it's very seldom that a guy who is in the medical profession in the United States really gets into a civil court, because there's other ways to hush up his case through the AMA. And the AMA is certainly nothing to brag about. I mean, they got stuck. You know, they got caught with that little scam that they tried to pull against the chiropractors recently. You know? Look, nobody's perfect, you know. People have invented certain rules to attempt to give the illusion that the world works. Some of the rules are good, some of them are not. The biggest problem we have in American government today is when a problem is realized, and they are popping up every day, we're just beginning to see the start of this legacy of the Industrial Revolution, which is the ruination of health and ecology on a global scale. You know, that's the price you're going to pay for all the evil shit that happened in the beginning of the century. Now, as the stuff comes up, instead of dealing with it in practical ways, there are attempts made to legislate the event away. Legislate the problem. The trick about legislation is no matter how you write the law, you got to enforce it. And I'll be kind. 90% of the laws that have been passed recently in the U.S. Congress are unenforceable. They're either unenforceable from a practical standpoint because it can't be done, or unenforceable because it might be done, but nobody in his right mind would be willing to spend the money to actually make the enforcement possible. The new drug bill is one of those things. You can't really enforce it. There's not enough police. There's not enough jails. There's not enough courts. There's not enough judges, juries, anything to implement what's written in that bill. And the same holds true of just about everything else that comes out of the Congress. We would be better off in this country if we would spend 4 years, one whole administration, ridding ourselves of useless laws that don't work.
And that's right.
That's the problem. These laws exist to create work for lawyers. But contemporary society has gotten so complicated that you could be violating the law without even knowing it. And that's the whole idea of Joe's Garage, the criminalization of America. You are still responsible for your actions. You can still be called a criminal even if you didn't know that the law was there. So who can know? There is no one person in the United States right now who will stand up and swear that he understands the U.S. tax code. It's too complicated. And if you take that on a state-by-state basis and think of the body of law that exists on the books in every state in the U.S., compounded by federal law, compounded by case law, and you are totally at the mercy of a legal system that could perhaps even have you killed for violating something you didn't even know existed. You know, I believe there's still some states that you have a death penalty for oral copulation. New Jersey, North Dakota.
Well, what are the 9 types of industrial pollution? These holdovers, these old institutions are running amok with these old techniques, and they're not really under control. And there's a clash of different media, different institutions in the rest.
Funny thing about that song title is at the time that it was put on that album, there was no such thing as a concern over industrial pollution. It hadn't even been brought up as a topic. That I put that on that song just as a joke after driving from New Jersey.
Okay, so there were no 9. You had not categorized.
I mean, I only, you know, I could see 9 on that one trip. there may be more.
Well, the term was not in the regular media, no. Probably, with the group that started the MK Ultra in Montreal, the mind control company, which put this on the face of the McGill. The foundation around it is called, this is 52, the Human Ecology Foundation. So you're using ecology, but it was human ecology, mm-hmm. but a management sense.
Human engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Human engineering.
Yeah. But what do you, I don't know if I got that clear. Do you want peer group trials? Are you pointing out there are no peer groups possible?
Well, I'm pointing out an idiosyncrasy of the law. You want it? Make it work. If it won't work, then you're living a lie to keep it on the books. And that's only one.
Now that makes it'd be good to respond to that demand and change. But there's an element in your suggestion of the absurdity of the situation, right?
Of course. I mean, you have to look at the situation and see what's really going on here. You have a thwarted ideal. You have somebody designing an ideal situation. And through history, you see that it doesn't work. And then, instead of dealing with it because it doesn't work, you have people living a lie. And living a lie creates stress.
Pointing it out, it creates laughter, which helps relieve stress.
Yeah, but it doesn't solve the problem. It's like popping a pimple, but you still got a pimple.
This is like the human intelligence factor we're talking about. There's a catch-22 element here. You're pointing out the lie. Do you expect people to be able to apply the suggestion? Or would ask them to do it?
I'm asking people to do is simply this. In your own way, in your own life, every day, you are confronted with a piece of data. Don't just, eat it up. Just think about it for a minute. You have the right to process your own information based on the equipment that you were born with. That's your right. That's real freedom. You have the right to make up your own mind. Now, if you choose to numb yourself and to be bamboozled, you have the right to be bamboozled. But in your state of bamboozlement, you do not have the right to be a liability because of your self-imposed ignorance on other people who might want to do things the right way. If you voluntarily choose to be a numbskull, for whatever reason you've chosen it, that's fine. You have the right to be stupid. But you don't have the right to harm other people as a result of your stupidity. And you don't have the right to legislate your stupidity into existence, to force it on other people who have a clearer view of what things are.
Do you think the Institute of the Presidency, the checks and balances, do you think a president could, one man, a wise captain, implement some changes? Or is the society so complex that that institution would not be able to implement changes?
I think it's possible, sure. The reason it's possible is nobody has more access to the media than the president. And most of the evils of society can, in fact, be cured through information. We have a society that has been disinformed and, based on the disinformation, has made irrational choices. And that's what I mean by ignorance. The people who ordinarily might be smart are deprived of the data by which to make a rational decision. Those who would voluntarily make a rational decision don't have the data to do it. Nobody has got more control or access to the media than the White House press office. We've seen it. They've literally reshaped American history to their own ends. It truly is 1984. Black is white, white is black. 2 and 2 is 11. Whatever they want to tell you. George Bush is a college guy. Ronald Reagan is a great patriot. Nancy wants you to say no to drugs. She wants you to say yes to the extra clothes that come in.
See, the power of information in a situation when you want to media to communicate, the main manifest of what you talked about begins the word information. Do you think?
That's right. You have to be suspicious of the information. That's why it says information is not knowledge. Knowledge is not wisdom.
They just say information is not knowledge. What is information?
Any data that comes in, somebody presents you with something, I walk up to you and say 2 and 2 is 11. That's information. It's bad information, but it's information.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, if somebody comes up to you and says 2 and 2 is 11, and they have a presidential seal on their coat, and they, you know, they come in, they say 2 and 2 is 11, and they got bunting waving in the background, and balloons go up, you might consider it for a minute.
So
that's information. Information is not knowledge. Knowledge is the point at which you know something. Okay. Now, wisdom is the idea that you have a bank of facts. To behave wisely, you have to deploy those facts into some sort of, in some way. You deploy them. You can deploy them stupidly, or you can deploy them wisely. So information is not knowledge. Knowledge is not wisdom. Wisdom is not truth. You can take all the sorted pieces of information, which gives you a knowledge base. You can act in what you believe is a wise procedure, but that is not necessarily any ultimate truth. And just because something is an ultimate truth doesn't mean it's beautiful. And just because something is beautiful certainly doesn't mean you have to love it. Because there's lots of ugly stuff that you could love to. I love my dog. Not a particularly attractive dog, but that's a wonderful dog. Okay? And
how do they continue that?
Information is not knowledge. Knowledge is not wisdom. Wisdom is not truth. Truth is not beauty. Beauty is not love. And love is not music. Music is the best.
Love is not music. What is love?
It's chemical. Merely chemical.
And it can be...
chocolate induced.
And you have different rates of duration.
It can have different frequencies. Like, there are many notes that you could call a B flat. There's several of them on the piano. They're all called B flat,
yeah.
But they're all different rates.
Yeah.
But they're still called B flat or something.
Because
they're multiples of the same rate.
It seems that your studies in music, experience as a musician, you've seen that as a model for many other parts of human activity. And you can seriously see music, chemistry, and take this pattern.
Well, things work together. I mean, I see the universe as an interrelated thing. Not so much as one big, almost a complicated thing, but one big, simple motherfucker. Just, you know, it's race. There it is.
Yeah, there was a quote in the Spirit of Fashion that we had once where you said, time cancels out something, and there's no time. What we talked about, you summed up.
I don't remember that quote.
Well, I think you said waves come together, and waves come together, they cancel each other out.
I don't remember saying it, but I know what I'm talking about. There is such a thing as frequency cancellation. I don't think you can ever get it to be 100%, but you can reduce the amplitude of how loud something is by causing the waves to cancel each other out. That's one of the ways that they use to reduce the harmony recognition. By introducing a tone into the air conditioning you've got, which counteracts the low frequency hum. The waves cancel each other out. Now, if waves are time, you cancel away the wave.
Okay.
Okay.
So,
Let's
see. We've covered a lot of things that I want to talk about now. I noticed in several, various interviews, the phrase no comment has come up. I want to bring back circumstances now, you were asked about psychic phenomena, did psychic, you said no comment. Is there a reason why you would say no comment?
Yeah, because it's based usually on the person I'm talking to.
You don't think your information that you would give in response to that question?
Well, it's, sometimes there are certain people who can't understand what you're saying.
I see, so no comment means a reflection on the audience.
Yeah,
so dealing with.
Yeah.
And I noticed in other interviews when someone, this may be the same reason, when someone starts talking about 50s R&B, you'll say, now, you're moving into dangerous territory there.
Well, one of the reasons for it is most of the people who talk about 50s R&B don't have any recollection of it. If you're talking to somebody who wasn't alive during the 50s, then all they know about the 1950s R&B is Sha Na television show,
yeah,
or Happy Days. They don't know what it was, so I would rather not discuss it with them. Somebody knows, if I can talk to somebody in my own age bracket, who knows what the thing is, then fine. But you can't really have a conversation about that style of music with anybody who doesn't comprehend it because of the damage that's been done by the commercialization of it.
But when you say dangerous territory, you're saying, buddy, you better know what you're talking about if we're going to explore it, because you will get...
Well, I said it facetiously.
I'm
not expecting it.
But it's dangerous because it's so little known today.
Yeah, there's just no comprehension of it. We know about as much, really. No, that sounds like truly exaggeration. There's just certain types of music that have been ruined by media exposure. For example, what do we really know about Mozart? They made a movie about him and, you know, some of the Mozart records, but what is that? That ain't what Mozart was. Can we know? By the same token, can we really understand the mentality that went into producing doo-wop records unless you knew what that world was? And I think we got maybe about a 6-month turnover for each musical interest cycle now at this point in the age.
Interest cycle.
Whoever was the big hit 6 months ago. Okay, next. You know, it's got nothing to do with the quality of what the person did or what the music is about. It's just like, it's not new, so you don't want it. So, with that sort of mentality working in the marketplace, how can you address a musical marketplace with that mindset about something that has to be totally irrelevant to them? This is so many interest cycles ago. Why trouble in with the description of doo-wop?
And that brings in the time factor for consumers, in the sense that we live almost 200 years every 12 months in terms of brand turnover or possibilities for interest levels, I guess.
Interest cycles, yeah, and I think they're becoming shorter. I've also talked about the end of the world, whether it's going to be fire, ice, paperwork, or nostalgia. And there's a good chance that it's going to be nostalgia because the distance between the event and the nostalgia for the event has gotten shorter and shorter and shorter with each nostalgia cycle. So projecting into the future, you can get to a point where you take a step and be so nostalgic for that step you just took that you would literally freeze in your tracks to experience the nostalgia of your last step or your last word or your last whatever. And then the world just comes to a halt, remembering.
Now, that was McLuhan's point. So the electric environment creates a turnover of information retrieval and projection that society's returned to stone, which I see as recent as supposedly conservative. They're just freezing in the time zone. But there's an underlying paradox because they are also turning over these cycles fast.
Well, that's perverting the concept of what conservatism is. True conservatism is a guy who wants smaller government, lower taxes, and that's what and everything else that has been appliqued onto that term has more to do with religious fanaticism and fascist politics and stuff like that. Conservative is the wrong word. I don't think that Americans, the way they think of themselves as being nice, communist, fair, good natured, jolly little individuals, would willingly opt for fascism. But they can easily be tricked into it. All you have to do is tell them that it's a candy apple or it's whatever the lies are that are going on right now. I mean, literally, they are being molded into something that's potentially dangerous to the rest of the world, as Nazi Germany was in the 30s and 40s. But tricked into it by people who have just lulled them into this false sense of security, and they wave a little American flag over it, and everybody just has this knee-jerk reaction that they've got to buy it.
Well, if you're talking about nostalgia cycles, that may be why the election, that people have a sense of ending the election as soon as possible. They can't keep their interest on the 2-year campaign or the 12-month campaign like they used to.
Well, I don't know whether anybody truly wants to be interested in the campaign for 2 years. I think that's one of the reasons why they run them for 2 years, because they want to numb the electorate. They want to keep the voter turnout low. If you keep the voter turnout low, then you realize that the only people who have managed to stay interested long enough, they have to be the average guy who just wants to exercise his democratic right to vote. He's so turned off by the whole thing. He's seen these guys over and over. He's heard the lies. He's looked at it and just gone, yuck. And now it's not a privilege to vote. It's a horrible obligation. And they don't even want to know about it. especially when you tell them that the election's already over, then why should they bother? Why should they leave their job or go, especially on the East Coast, when it's cold, someplace in November to pull a handle or poke a hole in a piece of paper? Who cares? The election's over. They want you to believe that.
What is this? I mean, really, a major disservice caused by the television news. And if humanists or conservatives are really concerned, they'd say, we've got to turn off this electric environment as one of the means to attempting to solve all the problems.
Well, you can't. You have to use it. You can't just turn it off. I think the electric environment could be one of the greatest boons to mankind if it were run by people who have mankind's interest at heart. But there's not an ounce of that. There's no benevolence in the network guaranteed.
I'm reminded of Colby Reed back in the late 60s that if you really want to change society, infiltrate the military. Do you want to elaborate on that? Is that obvious? Do you think they could do that?
I don't think that any of the people who have, let's say, humanistic concerns ever took me up on that one. Because the military is something that's never going to be dismantled as long as people are in the current state of evolutionary development. They still believe in the need for war. And I believe that it is impossible to do away with the military from a practical standpoint just because there are people on this planet who are less sophisticated than ourselves who would be more than happy to do harm to us. So you have to be able to protect yourself from it. However, to do any job, one must, to do a good job, you should do it efficiently. You should know what you're doing, cut the bullshit, and go do it. I like to see people who are not bullshit people in positions where they make decisions. People who have more of a long-range view. You need people in every profession, in the military is a profession. People in every profession have a long range view. What is today's little action going to mean 25 years down the road? And why are we doing it? Is Grenada really necessary? Is Central America really necessary? Is Angola really necessary? What are we really doing? That's what I mean. I'm telling you people to go into the military because it is not my field of expertise, but I'm convinced that mathematics, the law of averages would indicate that somewhere out there there's somebody who has an aptitude for military thinking who is also a long-range thinker and who might care more about people than about rhetoric and politics. The military is or should be an organization which performs a service for the rest of society, just like a police force. As long as you need it, it should be reminded that it is working for the rest of the citizens. These are people who have been given a license to carry a gun and kill people with it. And they should not use that against the citizens which gave them the license. They should always act in the interest of the citizens who gave them permission to behave in the militaristic way.
So you're saying in the 60s, late 60s, you made that proposal, nobody responded to it or said, I'm going to do it.
Well, they never called me up and said, good idea, Frank. I'm going in now. Thanks for suggesting it. None of that kind of feedback. But I'll tell you, one of the other things that I suggested, and it's been twisted and really turned around, turned out to be really true, even though it was twisted and turned around. I also suggested you can make the world better by going into media, which is exactly the reason why Falwell and Robertson have these colleges and so many people go into media. They're going to use the same thing to put their clones in place to keep the lid on stuff. And they're out there. I mean, there was a guy who graduated from Robertson's University who was working at Fox Television Network on the Gun Ribbon Show. They're out there. They're already in place. These are like moles.
Yeah.
You don't know that they came from that brainwash camp, but they're out there to do the supposed work of the Lord. And if you're talking about a Christian Lord, you're talking about doing the work of an imaginary deity that wants to keep people stupid. That's the job.
Yeah.
So these are people who ultimately, when they're in place, will keep content, in quotes, from managing to get into the airwaves.
Did you feel in the 60s that you knew the media inspired people who are having to do it? The odds were against it. I see that you're saying, well, the 80s said, look, see the enemy of the kingdom. The people who don't have your interests in mind have done what I heard many years ago. And you replay that by saying, they'll vote at the first level. How could you begin to implement what you see as to tell the people in position? I would urge them, if a threat, they're going to be killed. People react, they panic.
I wouldn't. I think the person is truly intelligent and they're finding a way they don't need me to tell them what to do.
So then why do you say just remind people that?
Well, I hope that there are some people who are teetering on the brink of being consciously intelligent who will opt for it rather than opt for the quaalude life. Yeah. If you've got the chemical machinery in your body, which is a functioning brain, and you have free will, and you can choose to be stupid or you can choose to be smart, I say choose to be smart. It ain't as bad as you think. The problem is most people choose to be stupid because there's a social stigma attached to being smart. If you're smart, you don't get laid. I mean, that's something that every kid learns in school. The other thing that used to be true, well, it's not so true anymore, is nobody wants to fuck a comedian. Now it's different a little bit.
Yeah.
But that used to be an accident. Nobody wants to fuck a mad scientist either. So the people have steered, Americans have steered themselves away from intellectual pursuits because, they want to have a social life. And the ones that have been the most victimized by it are the women who have made themselves stupid. I think there's probably a lot of smart women in the United States. I mean, if we trace it all the way back to Eve, who was smart enough to suggest that idiot man eat that damn apple,
Yeah.
Obviously, she knew something he didn't know. She knew the apple was something worthwhile, and now the guy's been blaming her for all his time. See that? No, you want me to go buy your Kotex for you? Okay. But women are pathetic when they make themselves stupid. There is even more of a stigma to being a smart girl than there is to being a smart guy.
Well, you talk a lot about sex and say you're both taking it. Are you one of your strategies to say, look, I'm a smart guy and I get laid?
It is absolutely a fact. And, there you have it.
It can be done.
It can be done.
Did you get laid much in high school, or were you interested in that at that point?
Well, being a normal American teenager, I was very interested in it, and I was truly blessed that I had a teenage girlfriend who lived like 3 doors away from me. So, yeah, I was having a wonderful time in high school.
That's not the one you first married?
No. I didn't even know about it. Eventually, the girl that I was going out with in high school, her parents decided that we shouldn't be so serious, and they moved away so that I could see her.
But you were sexually involved?
Yeah.
And you used condoms?
No.
You were careful?
Well, this is something that I believe is not germane to our philosophical conversation.
Okay. you said here another quote on a long line of relating people working in their institutions, and I think you set an example of time. Engage yourself with the musical establishment and reflect integrity. And down your part, hoping other people in the military are infiltrating and getting the positions that they'll implement.
Do your part.
Hmm?
Do your part.
Yeah.
Pull your weight. Don't be a flake.
You were interested in politics. You were interested in politics to talk to people, though. You said that in the late 60s. No. Many people thought in the 60s, I think, the way you presented maybe by the media economy is arrogant or that people were.
Well,
made them aware they were too stupid on.
Well, I think one of the techniques used to neutralize a person who has intelligence is to make them out to be a bad guy. And I'm not a bad guy, but I think what's been written about me in print has basically been designed to make me less appealing to a broad-spectrum American public. It's the same syndrome as why I don't have a talk show on television. They don't want to give me a moral. And take a look at the people who are touted as being wonderful, wonderful human beings. I mean, some of these people I know personally, they are this kind of way. But there are people who will never rock.